I'd like you to take your Bibles this morning and once again turn to Exodus chapter 22. This will be the Eighth Commandment, part 5. In Exodus 20, of course, we're going to be in Exodus 22 again, but Exodus 20 and verse 15 provides us with the basic commandment, thou shalt not steal. But just two chapters later, as we find out, we are provided with the first of several of many Eighth Commandment statutes. And I find it interesting, too, that, again, God didn't seem to have an order of here are the commandments and here are all the statutes that go under this commandment, and He even didn't necessarily deal with them even in a random way in order, because all of a sudden we've gone from Exodus chapter 20 that provides us with the Ten Commandments to now just two chapters later and we're into the Eighth Commandment rather than the First or Second Commandment statutes. So why God did that, I don't know, but I am glad, as I've said in the past, that He didn't just give us an outline of here's the commandments, here's their statutes, and here's the judgments, because He's made it so that we have to dig. And again, as I've said on many occasions, gold mining is fun if you're at least if you're finding the gold, and the gold's there to be found if we'll just do some digging. In the last two messages, we've examined the Eighth Commandment statutes provided in Exodus 22, verses 1 through 6. And let's just jump right back into this chapter and pick it up in this message with verse 7. In fact, since we have some people here this morning that haven't heard the previous messages, let's just go ahead and read verses 1 through 6 again, and picking it then up with verse 7 on through verse 13. Starting with Exodus chapter 20, verse 1, it says, if a man shall steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. And we did deal with the differences, why that was required in those two situations or in comparable situations today. Verse 2, if a thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. If the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood shed for him. For he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Now, you might keep the last part of that. Those two verses we have not dealt with, will not deal with in depth until we get to the judgment section of this commandment. But don't miss the second part of that, because we'll deal with that just briefly in regards to something we find here later. Again, verse 3, if the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood shed for him, for he should make full restitution. And then it says, if he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Verse 4 and continuing. If the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or ass or sheep, he shall restore double. If a man shall cause a field or vineyard to be eaten, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed in another man's field of the best of his own field, and of the best of his own vineyard shall he make restitution. If fire break out and catch in thorns, so that the stacks of corn and standing corn or the fields be consumed therewith, he that kindleth the fire shall surely make restitution. Now, we've covered those verses essentially at this point. Picking it now up with verse 7, it says, if a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. We did cover that verse earlier as well. Verse 8, if the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he have put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. For all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing which another challenges to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. If a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass, or an ox, or a sheep, or any beast to keep and it die, or be hurt, or driven away, no man seeing it, then shall an oath of Yahweh be between both, that he has not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. And if it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. Verse 13, and if it be torn in pieces, then let him bring it for a witness, and he shall not make good that which was torn. All right, the last seven verses, the ones that we haven't covered to date, all address statutes that are relative of to when one man, and we'll just identify him as party number one, deposits property for safekeeping into the care of someone else whom we will identify as party number two, just to try to make this a little simpler. Now, all of those seven verses deal with that particular aspect. Now, there's some verses we read beyond that, and we'll get into those later. But those first seven verses of that section deal with party number one depositing goods into the hands of party number two for safekeeping. Now, let's break that section, those seven verses, down into a more manageable portions. We addressed verse 7 again a couple of weeks back. Verses 8 through 9 address when a theft occurs of party number one's property while in the care of party number two in a case where the thief has not been apprehended, and therefore party number two is suspect and is accused of the crime. Let's read those verses again, verses 8 and 9. Verse 8, and if the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he hath put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. For all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing, which another challenges to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. So, with that in mind, if the judges decide in favor of party number one, the party who gave his goods to be watched by party number two, if the judges decide in favor of party number one, party number two is required to pay double what was put into his care and was lost, he being the one who was judged or determined basically to be the thief. So he falls into the thief of the category, or in the category of the thief. But note also that if the judges determine that it was nothing more than a false accusation on the part of party number two, or excuse me, a false accusation against party number two by party number one, that it is party number one who then is required to pay double to party number two. And that may be missed in this verse, but look at verse 9 again. Again, it says, let's pick it up with about halfway through. It says, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn of the two parties, they could condemn either one of them, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. You say, yeah, but the one didn't lose anything. His goods weren't stolen from him. It makes no difference. This would be in fulfillment of the law against perjury or false accusations that's found in Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verses 16 through 21. And I'll just read this to you without us turning to it. It says there that if a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is, here we go again, just as this verse talks about, shall stand before Yahweh, before the priests and the judges, who of course represented Yahweh in these cases when they adjudicated according to his law. He says, which shall be in those days, and the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness. Oh, by the way, I just caught this. Don't miss. It wasn't the lawyers looking into this. We're no lawyers provided for in the Old Testament, I guarantee you. Only judges. And there was no necessity for juries either. You want to know that the judges were the jury. And after diligent inquisition, it says, and behold, if the witness be a false witness and has testified falsely against his brother, then shall you do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shall thou put away the evil from among you, and those which remain shall hear and fear and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you. And don't let anybody try to kid you and tell you that judgment doesn't deter crime. That statement you find time and again after the judgment of Yahweh is talking about. It time and again says, and those which remain will hear and see and shall henceforth commit no more such evil among you. And then it says, and thine eye shall not pity. And we've got to be careful with that because we tend to want to be a pitying people. But it says, thou, I shall not pity. But life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, and foot for foot. Now, to the average American today, that law in itself just seems so bizarre. That if a man was to cut off my hand, that I would have the right to go and cut off his hand. But you think if I didn't do that, if the judges didn't require that, that there'd be a whole lot less people that would come along and want to cut off somebody's hand, knowing that they're going to lose their own? It's a great law. It's a great judgment. And it certainly deters crime. But, with all of that in mind, what if party number one's goods were stolen by someone else while in the care of party number two? I'll use Dick as an example. Let's say that Dick represents party number one, and that he came to me and said, would you take care, we're going to be out of town, you take care of my goods here. And while in my care, those goods were stolen by someone else. What then? Would it be required of me to pay restitution to Dick in that case? That was in my care, so the question is, would I be responsible or not? In such a situation, I didn't steal it. Somebody else stole it. What do you think? Well, I don't know if it'd be the case under God's law or under today's law. I hadn't thought of that. I'm not going to take the time to think about it too deeply right now. But if today's courts require it, they're actually in harmony with God's law. Look at verse 12. We read it, but you might have missed it. It says in verse 12, and if it be stolen from party number two, from in this case from me, why am I always the bad guy? Let's make Dick the bad guy. And if it be stolen from him, or me in this case, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. I didn't steal it, but it was put in my care. And you might say, yeah, but, I mean, and this would be the natural way to think of it, yeah, but it could have been stolen from Dick as well, you know, or just as easily. Yeah, it could have been. But the fact is, in this scenario, it wasn't. It was stolen from me, under my care. And therefore, according to Yahweh's laws of restitution, according to Yahweh's laws, restitution would be required. Or compensation, in this case, would maybe be a better word. Because while under my care, under my supervision, it was then that it was stolen instead of under his. And therefore, it would be my loss and not his. Question then becomes, how much restitution? Well, the Bible doesn't, in this specific case, it does not say. But I think we can, and so we can ask the question, would it be comparable, let's break this down, would it be comparable value, would it be four times the amount, five times the amount, or double the amount, four times, or five times the amount, or a commensurate amount? What do you think? Okay, the value of it. And I think that's the case. Although this verse doesn't say that's the case, we've already previously seen that the restitution for negligence, where it's just a negligent situation, that it's of comparable value. So it would be a horse for a horse, a car for a car, etc., whatever the case or whatever the situation would be. All right, let's continue going on to another section of this. Verse 10, it says, if a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep, or any beast to keep it, and it die, or be hurt, or driven away, no man seeing it. That is, there were no witnesses to the fact. Continuing verse 11, then shall an oath of Yahweh be between both, that he has not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. And if it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. We read that previously. In verse 13, if it be torn in pieces, then let him bring it for a witness. Excuse me. And he shall not make good that which was torn. And you say, well, if it was eaten, how can he bring it as a witness? Well, most animals aren't going to eat the hooves and the horns. So you could at least bring the hooves and the horns, or an ear that was probably marked like they do today. I understand that they marked ears back then as well for identifying an animal. So at least you could bring the hooves and horns. All right. Now, in these instances, that is death by natural causes, self-inflicted injury in the case of an animal, or being driven off is another thing that it says, and that must be understood. It doesn't say this, but it has to be understood as being driven off by a carnivorous animal rather than by a thief, because, again, theft is once again addressed in verse 12. So in these instances, that is death by natural causes, self-inflicted injury, being driven off by a carnivorous animal, or being eaten by a wild animal, party number two, according to those verses, in these types of instances, is not to be held responsible in any way. It's under his supervision, but he is not, in those situations, held responsible, because none of those would be a consequence of neglect. However, if you have your neighbor's best interest at heart, I mean, you're not required, but he's put it under your care, he was put into your trust, if you have your neighbor's best interest at heart, it may be the diplomatic thing to do, it may be advisable, it's certainly the honorable thing to do in such situations, to take the loss yourself nonetheless. That's what Jacob did, if you remember the case with Laban. In fact, let's turn to this. Keep your finger there in Exodus chapter 23 and turn back to Genesis 31. Because that's exactly what Jacob did, even when he was the victim, being taken advantage of by his father-in-law Laban. Genesis 31, and let's read verses 38 and 39. Now, Jacob he's finally had enough. I mean, he's only going to take so much. He's been taken advantage of, I think it says, 10 times by Laban. He's changed his wages 10 times or something like that. And he's finally said, I'm packing up and we're leaving. And Laban has now come after him. And that's the setting that we're talking about here. And look at verse 38 and 39 in this case. It says in verse 38, this 20 years. Now, Laban has caught up with Jacob here, and Jacob is giving his defense. And this is part of it. Verse 38, this 20 years have I been with thee. Thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast their young, and the rams of thy flock have I not eaten. That, and then verse 39, that which was torn of beast, one of those things that's dealt with in those last two verses we read, that which was torn of beast I brought not unto thee. I bear the loss of it. Of my hand didst thou require it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. And so, even when it was torn by beasts, now he was required to fulfill, if it was stolen from him and under his care, then he was to take care of it. But he added to that, and he says, I even took care of that which I'm not required to by the law of God. By the way, notice too, the law in effect, all the way back there at Jacob, again in that particular case. I need to add that to that list of different things that we do have listed prior to to Mount Sinai, showing that the law was indeed in fact before the codification of the law at Mount Sinai. But how much better to do what Jacob did? And don't you think that was one of the reasons that God honored Jacob as he did? I'm sure it was. You know, he was certainly without reproach, at least in this particular instance as it came with Laban. And Yahweh does honor such people who fulfill their obligations even when it's to their own harm or disadvantage. For example, in Psalms 15, 1 through 5, in a list of things that God says he honors, listen to this. David wrote and said, O Yahweh, who may abide in thy tent? And don't you want to abide in his tent? I like the way that's it. The idea of that. You know, abiding in his tent with his covering over us. O Yahweh, who may abide in thy tent? Who may dwell on thy holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness, who speaks truth in his heart, he does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor. Don't try doing evil to your neighbor and figure you're going to get in the tent. He does not slander with his tongue, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear Yahweh. And then it says, and swears to his own hurt, and does not change. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. Amongst those was one when he makes a compact, an agreement, a covenant with someone else, and The other even if with the other person having disingenuous motives, he still fulfills his end of the agreement or the compact. All right, with that, let's go back to Exodus 22 and pick it up where we left off again. Verse 11 through 13. Verse 11, then shall an oath of Yahweh, in those situations, then shall an oath of Yahweh be between them both, that he has not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good, and if it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. If it be torn in pieces, then let him bring for a witness, and he shall not make good that which was torn. All right, in such situations as described in those three verses, because, once again, because negligence was not a factor in these particular instances, no restitution was required. The only thing required to absolve party number two in those kind of situations of any wrongdoing, and therefore of the necessity of restitution, in the case of something, once again, that was eaten by a carnivore, would be just simply the evidence that that had happened, the hooves and horns or whatever else could be provided. And then in instances in which the animal had died of natural causes or had suffered, again, self-inflicted injuries or that had been driven off by wild animals, the only thing that was required was for party number two to swear by the name of Yahweh, to take an oath that the fact that he was innocent. And that was it. Again, Exodus 22, 10 through 12, the outer part of it, and an oath before Yahweh shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept him, and he shall not make restitution. By the way, I believe that is the very statute that Hebrews 6:16 is referencing, and I had never saw this until I put together with this message. But in Hebrews 6:16 it says, "For men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath given as confirmation is the end of every dispute." It's got to be referring to that very same statute right there in Exodus chapter 22. By the way, notice the law isn't done away with after the death of Christ either, because there it is in effect with that very verse as well, or at least one example of it. Now those were days, even at the time that the book of Hebrews were written, those were days when such an oath actually meant something. Compared to today, not like the vast majority of those taken in our modern courts today. And that's where that came from. You know, an oath upon the Bible that originally it used to be the Bible. They've gotten rid of that as well. But the oath, not only have they made the Bible and the name of Yahweh of none effect, they've made the oath of none effect. Those oaths don't even mean anything to our presidents anymore in courts. Demonstrated by our past president, Clinton Jefferson, William Jefferson Clinton, thank you. I don't want to remember his name if I don't have to. And by the way, by every other modern president who swears by the Bible and then repeatedly breaks his oath of office numerous times while he's in office. And what does that mean for him to stand there? They all do it. Half the time, they don't even get through the day without breaking the oath. They're already signing into law something that's already non-constitutional, let alone breaks God's laws. Adam Clark had some interesting remarks in this regard. He stated this in his commentary. "So solemn and awful were all appeals to God considered in those ancient times that it was taken for granted that the man was innocent who could by an oath appeal to the omniscient God that he had not put his hand to his neighbor's goods. Since oaths have become multiplied, and since they have been administered on the most trifling occasions, their solemnity is gone, and their importance little regarded. Should the oath ever reacquire its weight and importance, it must be when administered only in cases of peculiar delicacy and difficulty, and as sparingly as in the days of Moses." Now, I'm not so sure of the last part of that. I'm not so sure it was so sparingly. It just wasn't mentioned all that often. But But when they would do so, it was done with the understanding that if I swear in the name of Yahweh and I do not fulfill my oath, my part of the covenant, that I am calling the wrath of Yahweh down upon me. And of course, they've thrown that part of it out of it as well. And there is no, what a difference. Let's just sum it up by saying, what a difference. What a contrast between then and the emphasis and the import that they put on an oath in the name of Yahweh and what we have today in our courts today. Now, that section and those statutes cover things damaged, lost, or destroyed when party number one has put his goods into the care of party number two. But what about when party number two, that section deals with somebody putting something into the care of party number two. But what when party number two initiates the transaction, for lack of a better term, that is when party number two borrows from party number one and the goods are damaged or lost? One is party number one puts it in care of party number two. The other one is party number two initiates it by asking or borrowing something from party number one. Well, let's look at verses 14 and 15 again. Verse 14, and if a man borrow aught of his neighbor, so now we're dealing with borrowing. Does God's law deal with just about, does he deal with every possible aspect? Certainly does. You say, well, why would there be a difference? Well, let's read on. Verse 14, and if a man borrow aught of his neighbor, and it be hurt, or die, the owner thereof being not with it, he shall surely make it good. Verse 15, but if the owner thereof be with it, he shall not make it good. If it be a hired thing, it came for his hire. All right, there's three points to consider in those two verses. The first two have to do with things borrowed, and the third has to do with things hired or rented. So we'll get to that a little bit later. According to these statutes, if a man borrows something from his neighbor, and it is either damaged or, in the case of an animal, it actually dies, the borrower is required to make compensation or restitution. In fact, this particular statute, brought more meaning to something that I've wondered about, and I'll bet you have too as well in the Bible. Keep your finger in Exodus chapter 2 and turn to a story that we find in 2 Kings and chapter 6. And there's many of these kind of situations in the Word of God that you read the account and you think, well, what does that mean? And oftentimes, if you go back to the law, all of a sudden you'll find out why people reacted in the fashion that they did. 2 Kings chapter 6, beginning with verse 1. Reading through verse 5, and it says, and the sons of the prophets said unto Elisha, behold now, the place where we dwell with thee is too straight for us, or too narrow, too small. Let us go, we pray thee, unto Jordan, and take thence every man a beam, and let us make us a place there where we may dwell. And he answered, go ye. And one said, be content, I pray thee, and go with thy servants. And he answered, I will go. So he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down wood. Verse 5, but as one was felling a beam, the axe head fell into the water, and listen to what he said, and he cried and said, alas, master, for it was borrowed. Now, have you ever wondered about that? First of all, the story, and of course the story goes on, a lot of people would, you know, that can't happen. Well, God is able to use his prophets and his men to accomplish a lot of different things that most men would consider as being ridiculous. But I'm not going to get into that. But have you ever wondered, why did he cry out? Why did he make such a big thing about it being borrowed? Well, it doesn't tell us, but I believe it illustrates, again, this statute. And the reason I think that this young man was so concerned this item being borrowed, now obviously lost, except for Elijah's intervention in this situation, was that probably, you know, the prophets weren't wealthy men in any stretch of the imagination, I'm sure, back in those days. This was one of the sons of the prophets, probably in schooling, and he's concerned. This thing was borrowed. And probably what the case was is that this young man was without the means to replace it. And therefore, that goes back to that one part of that verse I told you that I wanted you to pay special close attention to. And therefore, he would have or could have been put into temporary servitude, a slave to another man, if you will, until that was paid. So, again, here's a story that goes back. If we understand the law, all of a sudden we can understand why, you know, this is the way it was. When the owner initiates the transaction, restitution isn't required in those situations where no negligence was involved. Whereas, when the borrower initiates the transaction, restitution is required in those same kind of situations. Now, and think about it. Doesn't that make sense? In that the one with whom something is deposited for safe keeping is simply doing a good deed or a favor to the one who asked him to do so. And not that he doesn't have any liability whatsoever. We've already seen that he does. One with whom something is entrusted, that is put, and think about this, put in trust. That's where that term comes from. Is under some obligation or has a certain amount of responsibility and therefore liability by the very meaning of the word trust. In fact, here's Bouvier's Laws Dictionary's definition, or at least part of his definition for the word trust. Bouvier's Law Dictionary, Volume 3, page 3,328. Aren't you glad you don't have to read that book? That's only about halfway through the third volume. But here's just one paragraph of a part of his definition for trust. An obligation upon a person arising out of a confidence reposed in him to apply property faithfully and according to such confidence. I guess that's the end of it, and then he cites some cases. Which is right out of Exodus chapter 22. A man who entrusts, who puts in trust his property into the hands of others. Now, there are people that I've run across who do not believe that trusts are biblical. In fact, if some of you might remember that several years ago I sponsored a trust seminar up in Estes Park, Colorado, and I had some people write me that it was just ungodly for me to have done so because trusts aren't biblical. Well, trusts are, or at least the biblical precedent for trust is found in Exodus chapter 22, verses 7 through 13. Now, this doesn't mean that all trusts are biblical or that all trusts are handled biblically, but trusts are nonetheless a biblical concept. The very word trust, you know, that's the problem with trust today. You can't find anybody to trust. You know, but God intends for Christians to live their lives in such a way that they can be trusted and things can be put in trust with them. And in those verses, it is clear that under certain circumstances, using now the legal terms, if you will, or even the lawful terms, under certain circumstances, the trustee is responsible for restitution. That is, when the trustee has been personally irresponsible with that which he was entrusted. But when in a situation where it is beyond the direct control, influence, or power of either party involved, only the initiator or of the transaction or the agreement or compact or covenant is to suffer the loss. Therefore, in a trust situation, it's the trustor who's the initiator and who therefore suffers the loss when something dies of natural causes or injures itself or is run off by carnivores. But in the case of the borrower, he being the initiator suffers the loss in such situations. That makes sense? It makes sense. I mean, it just you can see it all depends on who the initiator is. And so there would be a difference in those two scenarios. And after all, the owner of that property, which was borrowed by someone else, could have just as easily said, you can come and use my tractor, but, you know, it's going to cost you so much a day. He could have said that. And in such situations, for the borrower not to make good what was damaged, lost, or destroyed would be a case of returning evil for good. Would it not? I mean, he said, yeah, just grab the tractor and run with it. You know, go plow the field. You know, grade your road, whatever was necessary. And for him not to make good, if it was lost or damaged under his supervision, it would be simply returning evil for good. Therefore, once again, in the case of a borrow, he being the initiator suffers the loss in such situations. Unless the owner came with the animal, or the tractor, or the road grader, or the chainsaw, etc. Andy, you came and helped me with the chainsaw. Good thing it kept working because you were there and was present when the loss occurred. Then it would be an entirely different situation. Look back to Exodus 22, verse 15. First part says, "But if the owner thereof be with it, he shall not." Party number two is not required to make it good. In such a situation, the owner would, of course, it's his property. He would be, he says, "I'll come along and I'll help you grade the road." Well, it's under his, he becomes, in that situation, the principal supervisor, and the loss then is his. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary said this in that regard, adds to that thought. It says, "But if the owner thereof be with it, he shall not make it good. In this supposed condition, the exemption of the borrower from all liability was evidently founded on the presumption that no one would use a beast ill in presence of its owner, and that proper care was taken of it by the fact of his presence and sanction. The same thing if it were hired instead of being borrowed." So it just, the idea of, again, if it's hired, then you're paying for it, you're going to take care of it. Of course, once again, the Christian thing to do in such a situation, what might be called a good neighbor policy, would be for the borrower, even in that situation, the neighbor came along and is helping you out, to still take the loss yourself. Or at least, the least you could do, not required, it's going that second mile, is to at least meet him halfway and pay for half the loss. But, another situation. But what if it was a situation where something was damaged or destroyed when it was neither in trust or borrowed, but instead something hired, rented, or leased? Well, the latter part of verse 15 covers that, and it says, "If it be a hired thing, it came for his hire," which is precisely how rental establishments work today. The replacement costs are figured into the overall rental prices of their thing. They've already taken care of. It's a part of the contract. You don't have to pay extra. You've already basically agreed to that. They've already established that there's going to be damage, and they'll take care of it by the rental price itself. R.J. Rushdoony, in the Institutes of Biblical Law on page 461, sums up this section very well. Quote, he says, "If a man borrows and damages the property of another, he is liable for the damages. He has destroyed or harmed the property of another man, and he is thereby guilty of theft. Restitution is mandatory. If the owner came to assist him voluntarily as a good neighbor, the damage is the owner's because his property was damaged while under his own supervision. This is all the more true if he was working for hire, because his rental of his services with ox, ass, tractor, or any other equipment includes the wear and tear, the maintenance and damages to his working equipment." End of quote. A pretty good summation. Probably say, why didn't you just read that in the first place and forget all the rest of that? So be it. All right, now back to Exodus chapter 22, and let's continue on with this chapter. First of all, verses 16 through 20 pertain to things unassociated with the eighth commandment. So let's skip down and we'll pick it up with verse 21. Verse 21, "Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow, a fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword. And your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless." Let's stop right there. All right, there's no question. I mean, that you might even say, well, where does that come in to play with the Eighth Commandment? I believe that comes right back to the Eighth Commandment, or at least principally comes back to the Eighth Commandment. And with that passage in mind and several others throughout the Bible, there is no question that Yahweh takes special notice of such people and also makes special provision for them. For the stranger, and for widows and orphans and other needy people. Turn, keep your fingers there again, and turn to Deuteronomy chapter 10. This probably is even a little more powerful in this regard. Chapter 10 of Deuteronomy, verses 18 and 19. Speaking of Yahweh, it says, He does execute the judgment of the fatherless and the widow, and loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. Verse 19, Love ye therefore the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You know, there's far too many people who understand the message that we have, and we understand that, let me tell you, may very well find themselves under the judgment of God, particularly when it comes to the stranger, the non-Israelites sojourning in our land. God says, except for a couple exceptions, which are pretty minor, He says that the stranger, while here under Israel's law, is to be treated just like Israel, and not with disdain or corruption. And usually, back in those days, if they were there, they were there because they had seen what it meant to serve Yahweh, and were there at least in respect of Yahweh, and had come to the land and willingly put themselves under the laws of Yahweh. And they were to be respected, taught, or treated with respect, and beyond that, according to that, God says, I love them. And therefore, you better love them too and treat them respectfully. In Psalms 146:9, it says, Yahweh preserves the strangers. He relieveth the fatherless and the widow, but the way of the wicked He turns upside down. Special instructions and provisions for the same type of people are provided many times throughout the law. For example, grain was to be left behind for widows and orphans and the stranger during harvest, as found in Deuteronomy 24:19-21. Including also every year, leaving the edges, the corners of the field were to be left for the widows and orphans and poor and the stranger. Also, the servants were to be given special hospitality at the feast, according to Deuteronomy 16:11-14. And they were to receive a special, all of these people were to receive a part of the special tithe of the third year in Deuteronomy 14:28-29 and other places, and were to be given or be taken care of during the sabbatical year as well, in Exodus 33:11-12. Also, let us not forget, in regards to these types of people, what James tells us in James 1, verse 29, where he says, Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of God is to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted in the world. I didn't pick up on this before, but note the word affliction here. That God says that's pure, undefiled religion when we visit the widows and the orphans in their affliction. The exact opposite of what we just read in Exodus chapter 22, where He says, Beware of the man who afflicts the widow and the orphan and the stranger. That statute against vexing or oppressing is probably a better way to look upon that. The stranger, that is the non-Israelite against sojourning amongst us, and or afflicting the widow and or her children, certainly applies, of course, to more than just the Eighth Commandment. For example, I could bear false witness against a widow or an orphan, and therefore I would be afflicting them as well, or a stranger. Or, you know, one could murder a stranger or a widow or an orphan, and that would certainly that would be afflicting them about as to the furthest extent you could. But when you think about it, you think about the terminology, it's actually the Eighth Commandment that those terms are particularly applicable to. Chains vexing and afflicting, for example, to taking advantage of, and I think you'll get a better picture of what's being discussed in those statutes. And to take advantage of the weak or the vulnerable or those less able to defend themselves is simply put to steal from them in one fashion or another. You've taken advantage of them, they're at a disadvantage, and you've stole from them. And so it's particularly an Eighth Commandment statute. We find this same statute as it concerns strangers, for example, in Leviticus 19, and it's tied directly to an Eighth Commandment statute. Let me just quickly go there and I'll read verses 33 through 37. Beginning with verse 33, it says, And if a stranger sojourn with thee in your land, you shall not vex him. Same statute, at least as it concerns the stranger. Verse 34, but the stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. And then in verse 35, you shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. So here is where we start tying it into the Eighth Commandment. In meat yard, in weight, or in measurement. Just balances, just weights, and a just ephah, and a just hin you shall have. I am Yahweh your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. And so we can see that the same statute is tied directly into the Eighth Commandment, or at least that Eighth Commandment statute. A statute, by the way, that we'll deal with later in the series. But I want you to note in this particular rendition of that statute that the stranger, that at that time, the stranger and the orphan and the widow is to be given first. The first thing it mentions is to be given equal justice or treatment under the law of Yahweh. Leviticus 19, verse 5, begins with equal judgment. No partiality in judgment. Not only your measurements, whether it be dry measurements or liquid measurements or anything like that, just balances. Not only in that regard, but it starts off with judgment or justice. And the same, of course, would apply to any disadvantaged person such as the poor. It's a principle that obviously would be extended to them. In Exodus 23, for example, the poor and the stranger, instead of the stranger and the widow and her orphan, in this case, it's the stranger and the poor that are lumped together as it concerns judgment or justice. And in fact, I want to read, let's go there. I know we're looking at a lot of scriptures here, but this is one of those messages that requires this. In Exodus 23, let me read this to you, in verses 6 through 9, thou shalt not wrest the judgment, there we are again, of thy poor in his cause. Keep thee far from a false matter, and the innocent and righteous slay thou not, for I will not justify the wicked. See how far I want to go here. Verses 8 and 9, and thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise and pervertest the words of the righteous, and thou shalt not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you are in Egypt, as it is how it goes on. In other words, again, to begin with, God requires equal justice or treatment under the law. And, you know, American courts were originally designed with that biblical premise in mind. However, don't be fooled. You know, they're still proclaiming that we have equal justice under the law. And it does come, and there was initially, because it came from that biblical statute. But do not be fooled. There is no longer, it's no longer the case, because if you're not wealthy under our current court system, and able, and unable, if you're not wealthy, and therefore unable to afford or buy the best lawyers, under our current system, there simply is no equal treatment under the law. You think that Bob could take on a corporation with all the lawyers, and you think he's going to win? He might, but I'll guarantee it'll be the exception. If he was to take upon the corporation who has all the expensive lawyers at their disposal, there is no longer, the way it's set up now, equal justice under the law. But at the same time, and that's in regard to the poor. But at the same time, don't think that this cannot also occur in reverse as well, just as easily, where the rich man is the one given unfair treatment and is put at a disadvantage. And God understood that. He said there's to be equal justice both ways. We read from verses 6 through 9, I believe it was, about giving the poor, making sure that the poor had equal judgment. Well, in verse 3 it says, neither shall thou countenance a poor man in his cause. Neither shall thou look to the poor man and give him the advantage over the rich man. So God said it can work either way. Let me read Exodus 23, 1 through 3, in fact, from the New American Standard. It says, you shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow a multitude in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. And then verse 3, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. God says you are not to be partial to the rich man, and you're not to be partial to the poor man either. Now, there are people who need to take heed to that verse 3 of Exodus 23, because there are people who, by their very nature, are especially merciful. No, they're just merciful people. My wife is one of those people. And she needs to, if she was a man and a judge, she would need to take special care of that. I can remember back when I was a salesman, and she tried to talk the guy out of the sale. It was far too much for me to be charging the poor guy. We're all sitting there at the table. All of a sudden, I'm making the sale, and she talked the guy almost out of it. You know, she's a merciful lady. And there are people like that who, therefore, have an automatic bias for the underdog. She didn't know. I was the underdog. I had to feed my family. She just didn't realize it. And that is, they're biased toward the underdog. That is, unless they are governed by justice, equity, and morality. I.e., that is, unless they're governed by the laws of Yahweh, which then assist them in overruling their emotions and their propensity to judge by their hearts instead of their heads. This is why it is so vitally important that we have an unchanging standard, not like what we've got today that's changed with the whims of men, wherever, whatever they are at any particular time in our history, but that we have an unchanging standard when it comes to law. That there is absolutely no change in it. One which overrules or balances, if you will, both the overly harsh and the too lenient. The austere and the overly tolerant. Because to be partial in judgment to either the poor or the rich, think about it, is to say that one is evil and one is not. Whereas Yahweh's law makes no distinction whatsoever except between the righteous and the unrighteous, the godly and the wicked. Now, back to bias against the rich. We talked about the poor. God takes special notice of that, but we need to deal with the rich in as well, the flip side of the coin. Any ideas where that occurs today all the time? How about in the halls of Congress? And in the Supreme Court, especially when they're controlled by the Democrats, which now there's hardly a dime's worth, a nickel's penny's worth of difference between Republicans and Democrats anyway. Now it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But their policies can be summed up as Robin Hood legislation. Taking. That's just a nice way to say stealing. Stealing from the rich to give to the poor. You know, it's too bad that we don't have statesmen today like Davy Crockett. I don't know if any of you have read one of his speeches to Congress in this regard about taking from the rich to give to the poor, which he was guilty of. And he was going the story, and I wish I had time. It's too long to read it to you, and I'll tell you where you can find it so you can read it. I'll just tell you now. It's U.S. Representative Ron Paul of Texas has it on his website at www.house.gov/Paul/NYTG, not yours to give is the title of it, .htm. Or I think if you just look up not yours to give, I'm pretty sure you'll find it. Do a search on that, you'll find this speech as well. It's a great speech where he's out on the stump for re-election, and this whole farmer's looking over the fence at him. He says, "There's no way I'm reelecting you, Davy Crockett." He said, "We trusted you, and you went and talked about a bill that they had passed to help a widow who had lost her husband, and they took the money." He says, "You're a thief, essentially." And Crockett recognized the fact that it was true, and he went and gave one of the best speeches that have ever been given in the House of Congress in this regard. You might want to read it. It's an excellent. You can get that cite from me later if you'd like. Now, that's one place. Boy, the halls of Congress right now, they're legislating that all the time. Where else does this theft of justice and equity and wealth occur? Well, probably the most blatant and possibly the most egregious is found, and I'm surprised somebody hasn't come up with this one, the graduated income tax, where the wealthy, the industrious, the diligent, the entrepreneurs is taxed at a higher rate than are the poor, and often which are poor because they are less industrious and diligent, simply because they're taxed more, simply because they're rich and they have more. The graduated income tax is theft, plain and simple, at least according to Yahweh's laws of equity and impartiality. Furthermore, it's also in principle the antithesis of Yahweh's way. Socialist man, his ways can be summed up in more from those who have more. Whereas, like it or not, Yahweh's way can be summed up in this regard as more to him who has more. Isn't that Yahweh's way? Mark chapter 4, verse 25. Whoever has, to him shall more be given. And whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken from him. In other words, Yahweh rewards the industrious, whereas unregenerate socialistic man penalizes the industrious and rewards the slothful in many cases. It's essentially just more of calling evil good and good evil. Everything's turned around backwards. Now back to Exodus 22. We're going to conclude this here real quickly. Note, as far as restitution is concerned, that there is not a harsher punishment for someone who oppresses the stranger or afflicts the widow of the orphan. The same laws of restitution, since it doesn't elaborate on it, we can go back to the previous principles and we can figure out what restitution was required. And the same laws of restitution, that is in man's court, under Yahweh, would apply. Nevertheless, do not miss the fact that in Yahweh's court, he warned that doing so might very well arouse his anger and unleash his wrath, and that he may, in fact, even kill the person if that disadvantaged person calls upon him for relief. Verses 23 and 24, again, we won't read it for the sake of time, but that's what it says. It would be a good idea for us to keep in mind, not only in what we do not do, but also what we possibly should be doing for the disadvantaged, that Yahweh is the defender of the defenseless. And Psalm 68:6 describes him as a father of the fatherless and a judge for the widows is God in his holy habitation. You know, now in light of those passages in Exodus 22, 23, and 24, you know, you have to wonder if when someone seems to be innocently murdered, if possibly it wasn't altogether that innocent after all. Because God says not that he will kill them, but if you remember, he says, I will kill them by the sword. In other words, at the hands of someone else. And that possibly it was Yahweh simply using the murderer to vent his anger and to accomplish his judgment on someone who had taken advantage of the widow or the orphan or the poor or the stranger. It does make you think, doesn't it? All of a sudden you think, well, maybe that wasn't an innocent murder after all. Maybe there was God's reason for it. Not in all cases, but certainly God has made it clear that in some cases that's exactly what he does. If the widow, if the orphan calls for him for help. Makes you think. And hopefully this series is getting you to think upon the Eighth Commandment in ways you haven't again thought before. Adding the statutes and the judgments of God, all of a sudden this opens up. Again, the more I'm into this, the more and more I see that this opens up, so it's going to be one of those series again. Praise the Lord, right? We get to be that much longer in God's Word and get to glean that much more. Once again, I hope you appreciate not only the depth and the breadth of Yahweh's law, too. It covers everything. But once again, the perfection of His laws as compared to the absolute imperfection of man's substitutes that we have today. Amen? What a God we serve. What a law He's given us. What a Savior we have. Let's stand and we'll close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, we're again very thankful to You and praise Your holy name and glorify You as our God, King, Judge, and Law.
and lawgiver, Father. We praise and magnify you and for all that you've given us, for being our Savior in Yeshua the Christ. And then, Father, beyond all of that, giving us your law, your word, Father, to govern our lives, to help us to live in such a fashion that we can live.